Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Dan Ashley, news anchor at KGO-TV, the ABC station in San Francisco, and very pleased to be your moderator for today's program. It is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker today, Senator Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader and author of The Good Fight. And some background. Born in the desert an hour or so outside Las Vegas in a town called Searchlight, Harry Reid watched his father work as a hard rock miner. He grew up poor in a small cabin without indoor plumbing and attended a two-room elementary school. Harry Reid learned early about hard work, accompanying his father as a small boy into the mines on occasion. While his father's formal education stopped in the eighth grade and his mother never finished high school, a young Harry realized that education was the key to his future. With help from local businessmen, Harry made it to college and then to law school at George Washington University. He made ends meet by working as a U.S. Capitol police officer. After law school, it was back to Henderson, Nevada, where he worked as city attorney. He was elected to the Nevada State Assembly in 1968 at the ripe old age of 28. In 1970, Harry Reid became the youngest lieutenant governor in Nevada history. After a stint on the Gaming Commission and a private law practice, he won the first of two terms in the House of Representatives. That was in 1982. In 1986, he was elected to the Senate. In 2005, he served as minority leader until the Democrats won control of the Senate in 2006, when he became majority leader. And here we are today. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Senator Harry Reid. Senator, just a terrific pleasure to have you with us today.
It's my honor to be here in the place that Mark Twain considered the coldest winter he ever spent was summer in San Francisco.
And he was quite right about that, as you well know.
We're just very quickly, Mark sure. Twain, you know, he was born in Nevada. People don't realize that.
So you'll claim him.
Yeah.
A hometown son.
Yeah.
Well, on the subject of all things literary, your story, The Good Fight, Hard Lessons from Searchlight to Washington. You had a tough beginning in Searchlight, grew up poor, difficult circumstances in many respects. How has that shaped you today?
Well, there are some things that obviously have had a tremendous impact. Health care, for example. You know, we have 50 million people, about 50 million people with no health care in America, and we have millions of others who are underinsured. When I grew up in Searchlight, and I talk about it in the book a little bit, there were no doctors available. We didn't go to doctors. There weren't any. We never went to Vegas to see doctors. My brother broke his leg. He still has the bent leg to prove that. He laid on a bed. I can still remember writhing in pain for several days. My dad, as I talk about here in the book, pulled his teeth with a pair of vice grips.
Literally?
I watched him do it.
Oh, my goodness.
My mother had no teeth. I can remember once they had a TB wagon that came through. I don't know, they came through every year, so I guess to see if anyone had tuberculosis. My mother had the test, and it came back positive that she had TB. No one went to a doctor. Obviously, it was a false positive. But I, as a boy, worried about that so much. Mm. I can't imagine how my mother must have felt knowing that this situation was there. So I really believe that it's a tremendous shame that there are still people today who are in the same situation I was in all those many years ago with no health insurance. So, yeah, it's shaped my life in a number of different ways. That's just one that comes to my mind.
Do you feel you're a better person having grown up with so little?
Well, I don't know what the alternative would be. As I grew up, I thought that all kids were basically in the same situation that I was in. So I never, as a little boy, and as a boy, I never felt sorry for myself. But as I, and just very briefly, when I left Searchlight to go to high school, they had no high school there, I was 13 or 14 years old, and I never boasted about being from Searchlight. It was something that I was kind of embarrassed about. We had no inside toilet. It was my parents were uneducated. My dad didn't graduate from the 8th grade. My mom didn't graduate from high school. So Searchlight is something that I kind of ignored. I ignored it when I was in high school, didn't talk about it. I didn't talk about it in college, law school. And I was an adult and then some before I realized that Searchlight is who I was. I couldn't run from Searchlight. And so after I came to that personal realization, I kind of put my arms around Searchlight. I later in life wrote a history of Searchlight because it's certainly the best one ever written because it's the only one. but I spent as a senator, I spent a year and a half or 2 years every weekend at night writing this book. So I now know that Searchlight is part of me. That's who I am. And that's one reason for the book.
And it's an interesting progression, isn't it, to go from being a bit ashamed of Searchlight to putting it on the cover of your book and talking about it so proudly and so profoundly.
Yeah.
That's a change.
Dan, it is. And there are a number of other things that are the same in my life. My dad committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And that was not part of my vocabulary. Suicide was something that happened to other people. So when my dad killed himself, it isn't anything that I ever talked about. Our family didn't talk about it. And it took a number of years before I came to grips with the fact that suicide is something that I shouldn't be ashamed of. 31,000 people in America every year kill themselves, and there's probably a lot more. Those are the only ones we know because there are a lot of deaths that are suicide that we don't report. And it wasn't until I was in the Senate and Mike Wallace, the famous journalist, was testifying before the Senate Aging Committee, of which I was a member. Bill Cohen from Maine was conducting the meeting. And Mike Wallace was saying, the meeting was on senior depression. And he said, there were periods in my life when I wanted to die. I wanted the worst assignments I could get, hoping I would never come back. And he said with a smile on his face, he said, I don't feel that way anymore. So I took a little bit of medication, somebody to talk to. I want to live forever. And he's almost 90 now. Mm-hmm. And so after that, I said, hey, I'm going to start talking about my dad's suicide and do something about it. And we have. Since then, we've passed laws. Centers for Disease Control is on top of this. We're having studies conducted, why people commit suicide. So anyway, there are a couple of things that I think in all of our lives that you don't come to grips with it real quickly. And the two things were Searchlight and my dad's death.
And we're going to spend a lot of time here in this hour talking about politics. But I wanted to start and focus on your story because I think a lot of people may not know a great deal about it and may find it very fascinating. One of the things that occurs to me as I hear you speak, Senator, about this is there so much in your book about your vision of the country and where you think things need to go and some of the issues that need to be addressed. But beyond the political nature of the work and your life, it occurs to me as you read about your father's suicide, your humble beginnings in Searchlight, that there are a great deal of Americans who have similar stories who may not address those issues. There is some self-help quality to reading about these sorts of things and realize here is one of the most powerful men in the United States government who has very ordinary beginnings and some very ordinary challenges. And I think a lot of people may find some comfort in that.
Dan, I have told kids in Nevada for many, many years, look at me. If I can make it, any one of you can. And then I proceed to tell them a little bit about, doesn't matter what the color of your skin is, doesn't matter what your religion is, we had none growing up, zero. It doesn't matter the education of your parents. My parents had no education. My dad didn't graduate from the 8th grade. My mother never graduated from high school, and on and on. And that's one of the reasons people say, why you write this book? It's the same reason I tell these kids. You know, my book is indicative of what a great country we have, in my opinion, because if I can make it, anyone can. And so I tell these young boys and girls, and now I'm telling the world, that this is a wonderful country, that we can make it no matter what.
Let's talk a little bit about the country and where we stand. You know, your book begins with some critical comments about the current President Bush, but some praise of the first President Bush. If you can just encapsulate where you believe America is at this moment.
I believe that the invasion of Iraq is the worst foreign policy blunder in the history of our country. I go out of my way in this book to talk about Ronald Reagan, who I didn't agree with a lot of things philosophically, politically, but he was a wonderful person to work with. And this man's father is the most qualified person we ever had.
Why is he pulling me out of here? Because he thinks I'm going to ask you why you keep funding the war? Why you let the Senate give $165 million
for
the war?
We'll give the senator the opportunity to answer that question.
Why are they pulling me out of here? Is it because
perhaps? Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to continue. We knew there would be something of a disruption, and that's fine. People have the right to express themselves.
I talked to the speaker earlier this morning. She said that these folks were at her house this morning when she got up.
They were at this morning. And, you know, I wish the questions came in the form of the way you guys have asked them, so that we ask and answer them
and
in a civilized way.
We'll make sure that the questions she asked... that I respond to those. I'll be happy to do that.
We'll talk about the funding of the war, and we will, because I think you're here.
So anyway, as I indicated, the war is costing us now $5,000 a second, 7 days a week,
believe...
So where is the country today? I think the war has set us back a long ways. All the money has been borrowed. Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, said the war will cost us $3 trillion. But in addition to that, what it's done to us around the world, we have in the Middle East, we have a civil war going on now in the Palestinian territories, Lebanon a civil war, a tractable civil war in Iraq. We have Iran thumbing their nose at us and everyone else. And if that weren't bad enough, our standing in the world community has fallen very, very much. When this man took office, President Bush took office, we had a surplus over 10 years of $7 trillion. We now, of course, that's all gone. It's going to take whoever the new president is, this isn't going to change in just a few months or a few years. It's going to take many years to get out of the hole we're in now. But at least we're not digging it deeper, I hope, starting January 20th.
Are we... Is this the state the country is in now? You talk about the invasion of Iraq as being perhaps the biggest policy blunder in U.S. history, in your judgment. Was that the one singular mistake, administration, or is it a constellation of factors that you would point?
We have been living for 7 years and 5 months in an Orwellian world. We have President Bush who came to town, saying he wanted to be a uniter, not a divider, that just the opposite has happened. He has been the most dividing factor person I've ever worked with in my entire political career. It's either his way or the highway. It's been impossible. I pride myself in being a moderate and being able to compromise, work things out. That's what legislation's about, is the art of compromise. That's not in his vocabulary. Take, for example, global warming. As we're here in San Francisco today in this building, we're having a world that's really being hit hard by global warming. And we've done nothing in 7 years and 5 months to do this. The first time we're going to try to do something is this Monday when we're starting the first global warming debate in the history of our country. We're doing that Monday in the Senate.
Is the vote this week scheduled?
Yes, Monday. We'll vote at 5:30 Monday for the first time. But even that, the Republicans are filibustering that, but we'll get 60 votes, I think, on this one issue. So, no, if it were just the war, maybe we could say, well, he made a mistake. But it's not just the war. It's this presidency has been so bad for our country and the world.
What will it take to reverse those decisions, in your judgment?
It's going to take time. There's not going to be a magic that's going to take place in a short period of time. But it's also going to take people working together. I don't think it's a secret to anyone here. We're going to pick up seats in the Senate. As we speak, there's 12 Senate seats that we're competitive in. Maine, New Hampshire, Virginia, North Carolina, New Mexico, Colorado, Oregon, Minnesota, Mississippi, Alaska, any 12 seats. So we're going to pick up seats. I don't know how many. But I am committed, no matter how many seats we pick up, we have to start hoping that there will be some moderation with the Republicans in the Senate. Senate Republicans, during the last many years, have not represented mainstream Republicans in this country. They represent the far right. We have only one moderate Republican anymore, and that's Olympia Snowe from Maine. There are no moderates. As I say in my book, Arlen Specter's with us every time we don't need him. So I'm committed to working. I don't know if there's going to be 40 Republicans or 42 Republicans or whatever it is, but we're going to have to start working together. We have to get away from the ideological impulses that people have developed over the last 10 years or so and move on and try to get some things done for the country.
You would consider yourself a moderate Democrat?
Yeah, I would.
Let's define moderate Democrat, because you have some views that I think some people might associate with Republican values.
Yes, I think I'm a moderate. You put it all together and I'm down the middle. I think that I've learned over my public service that people on the far right and the far left can't get anything done, that you have to work to build consensus, and that takes people working toward a middle ground on most everything. Anyone that's been a legislator and will not compromise has accomplished nothing. I'm fortunate that I've introduced a lot of legislation this past. I have never, ever gotten what I wanted. I've always had to say, okay, I think we better try to work this out.
What about the theory that the two extremes, far right, far left, ultimately pull us toward the middle?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I've never heard it put in that language before, but I think that's true.
So even the extremes balance one another out to some degree.
But it also confirms what I've said. The far right and the far left can't get things done.
Okay. I'm going to turn to some questions from the audience for a moment. And then this deals with some of the issues that you may describe as moderate or one side or the other. Is there any hope for progress on gun control, or is it, as it seems, no pun intended, a dead issue?
I believe that there has been limited progress in gun control. In 1969, as a freshman legislator in Nevada, I introduced the first gun control legislation in the history of the state. I was asked by the sheriff of Clark County, Ralph Lamb, to do something about establishing a waiting period for the purchase of guns. And I believed very strongly in what I was trying to get accomplished, and we got it done. We had in the state of Nevada a cooling off period for the purchase of guns. Now, as time went on, it became more political. I was long since gone out of the legislature, and a number of counties in Nevada, they've eliminated that. But in Clark County, where more than 70% of the people live, Las Vegas, that's still the law. That's why in Washington, as a member of Congress, I thought it was the Brady Bill was the right way to go. I think it's very important to make sure that you don't have a criminal, somebody that has emotional problems, being able to purchase guns. I think we should run a check on them. Some of the other things that have been tried haven't worked very well, honestly. As you know, there was a lot of to-do about assault weapons. Law was passed. In 10 minutes, there was a way around that. They just changed the definition of the gun. So there are things that can be done with gun control, and I think we've done some of them. It's also become a very ideological thing that I think people are unwilling to reason. I think the National Rifle Association has been really quite unreasonable on a number of occasions. I think they should have taken what you and I have just talked about. Let's reason together. Let's try to come someplace in the middle. So that's my short treatise on gun control.
All right. Another issue, as you are well aware, in the last 10 days or so, the California Supreme Court ruled that unions, marriages between same-sex couples are, in fact, constitutional. Your view on that?
Well, first of all, I think rightfully so. We have a situation in our country where states make those decisions. And knowing that was going to be the case in Washington a number of years ago, we passed a law called the Defense of Marriage Act that said states do not have to recognize the marriage laws of another state. So if the state of California wants to have this their law, fine. In Washington, we said that's fine. But if the state of Vermont, that wasn't a good example because they were the first to go with civil unions, the state of Kansas, they don't have to recognize a marriage between two men and two women that takes place in California. And I think that's fine. I think that there's nothing wrong with that. I think we have a pretty good system now, this federal system, where if a state wants to do it, and in California, you know, what the court has ruled is not final. I understand there will probably be some kind of a vote this November in California to determine if the Supreme Court was right. Now, even in California, things have changed. I was in L.A. yesterday, and I was listening to public radio, and there's a field poll that came out that said the numbers are changing even in California.
51% now apparently approve. Yeah. But from your perspective, you believe that marriage is between a man and a woman?
Of course. Yes, I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll move on from that issue. And if anyone wants to follow up, we can. You not only the war, but gave, this goes to the protesters' question to some degree, but gave President Bush more than he asked for to keep the war going. Why?
I would say to her, which time? Because this war is now in its sixth year, and we have tried, when we took the majority, I realized that one reason we got the majority, and the main reason we got the majority, is people were fed up with this war. And they expected us to end this war. But even before my 9 new Democratic senators were sworn into office, Tim Johnson of South Dakota was stricken with a very bad bleed in the brain, and he was unconscious for 5 weeks. He was out of work for 10 months. My majority dropped from 51 to 49 to 50 to 49. And then, all of a sudden, Joe Lieberman decides that he's going to vote with Republicans on this war. Now, he's supports me on most everything else, but the war, he supports the Republicans lock, stock, and barrel. So I found myself with 49. They had 50. It was a little hard to do a lot, but we still tried, valiantly tried. Since we took the majority, we have had 37 different votes on Iraq, and we'll have some more. The question is, it's been very difficult to get 60 votes to get anything done. We've been able to get up to 57. Led by Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, conservative Republican, who believed that the war was wrong, and he gave up his political career as a result of that. He was really a leader in that regard, but we needed 3 more Republicans, and we couldn't get them. So we haven't been able to change course in Iraq very much, although we've changed the course somewhat. And the question that lady asked, and I'll be happy to respond to it, why would the Senate approve funding for the war? I never voted. I have not voted for it. Everyone, I think, here knows how I feel about this war. But not all Democrats feel that way. Remember, there are 49 Republicans, so they only need 11 Democrats on any given issue. And every time there's at least 11 Democrats who feel, even though they may not like the war, they feel it's not right to not fund the troops that are in the field. Now, I have offered an amendment along with a senator from Wisconsin, Feingold. We've had it voted on 3 different times that says, and this is what I believe, we should in 4 months, or pick some arbitrary month period, but that's what we've usually done, 4 or 5 months, saying we want all the troops out of Iraq, but for those that deal with counterterrorism, those that are training the Iraqis, and those that are there to protect our assets. We believe that's what should happen. The question people always say, well, isn't there going to be chaos if we leave? Well, there's chaos now. So there's going to come a time when we have to leave, and I think that should be under the conditions I just announced.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We are talking with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and we've been speaking about the war in Iraq for a few moments. Question from the audience, Senator. Couldn't you say that Iraq has created a battlefield to fight al-Qaeda and the terrorists, in essence, keeping this battle out of the country, this country, perhaps echoing what you've heard President Bush say, that we fight them there so we don't have to fight them here? Is there any
credence to that notion? Ben, just reading that makes the hair on the back of my head stand up. Everyone in the sound of my voice should understand there were no terrorists in Iraq prior to this invasion. Saddam Hussein, bad guy. I'm glad he's gone. But remember, he was a Sunni. They were in the minority. They ran that country with an iron hand, and that's an understatement. There was no dissension there. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq. The reason they're there now is that we're the enemy. Who is the enemy of al-Qaeda? It's us. Once we leave, they have nothing to complain about. So we're losing ground on the battle against terrorists. We are in not as good a shape today as we were prior to the invasion of Iraq.
In what respect, Senator?
Well, first, we had the 9/11 Commission. We fought the president to get that, so people would understand why did we have 9/11? Why did it happen? The day before that was announced, Governor Kaine and Hamilton met with the four Senate leaders, two Republicans, two Democrats. I was the assistant leader at the time. And I asked those two men, it was in a private room, but certainly all this is public since then, we call it 407, where you do all the classified briefings. And I said, tell me why, what's going on? Who are these terrorists? And Governor Kaine responded by saying, terrorists around the world, there's only a few thousand of them. And the only thing we can do with them is kill them or capture them. You can't do diplomacy with them. You can't reason with them. But it's a finite number. He said, that's not the problem. The problem is the millions of people who sympathize with these bad people. And that's where we need to work. We need to have those people understand, those sympathizers, that we're good. We're trying to improve the world. They shouldn't sympathize with these evil people. And we're not making headway in that regard. That's too bad. We're not doing a good job with Peace Corps. We're not doing a good job on diplomacy. If there ever needed to be a surge, it would be a surge in diplomacy. So that's why I think that statement is ridiculous.
All right. Is it, you hear every day on the campaign trail, the drumbeat to get out of Iraq from the two Democratic candidates. If a Democrat is elected in November, realistically, when do you think the war in Iraq will wind down?
I think it'll start immediately. I think the wind down will start immediately. Does that mean they'll order everybody out Monday morning at 8 o'clock? Of course not. But it'll be somewhere along the lines that Reid and Feingold put forth in legislation. There'll be a time set. There'll be people left there to do the counterterrorism activities and let the Iraqis take care of their own country. You know, it's really a strange picture here. They have a surplus of more than $100 billion in their country, a surplus. And we're building roads and hospitals for them, and we're not building them here. And they have a surplus. They have either the largest or the second largest oil reserve in the world. And I think it's time that they took over their own country.
We talked a little bit about the acrimony in Washington. Senator John McCain has suggested that the next president conduct question and answer sessions with Congress similar to the British Prime Minister and Parliament. What do you think of that idea? It's from the audience.
I think it's like a lot of his ideas, not so good. I think that John McCain, I have some ability to speak with authority in this regard. I came to Washington with John McCain. We came to the House of Representatives together. We went to the Senate together. We're separated in seniority by one. He's one ahead of me. The reason he's ahead of me is because we had the same seniority, but for the fact that Arizona has more people than Nevada, that's why he's one ahead of me. His temperament is not good. He's wrong on the war. He's wrong on the economy. And I think that we have a totally different form of government than Great Britain. They have a parliamentary form of government. They have a prime minister, not a president. And I think his idea that we would want to have our government like Great Britain belies the fact that we have a great country totally different than Great Britain. We have a constitution. They don't. We have three separate independent branches of government. So I don't like his idea.
All right. What idea do you like to improve the relationship between Congress and the president and congressmen and women and their fellow congressmen and women? There is a great deal of anger and angst, it seems to me. And these days, I've called it the coarsening of America, and I see this not only just in Washington in politics, but across the country in many respects. Not only do you disagree with someone, that person is wrong, bad, and evil for having that opinion. We no longer have civil disagreement.
I've been in Washington during times that didn't take place. When I came to Washington, Reagan was president. Tip O'Neill was the speaker. Now, there were ideological battles between those two men. But at the end of a day that they pointed fingers at each other and tried to convey their ideas as being the best, they would end the day, go find a piano someplace, and sing a few Irish songs, have a couple beers, and go about their business. The Social Security crisis of 1983, how was that resolved? It was resolved because no one wanted credit for taking care of the program. They worked together. Reagan and Tip O'Neill, other congressional leaders, said, this is a problem. Let's finish it. Let's fix it. I'm sorry. And they did. Within a period of 3 months, they took care of Social Security.
What was the difference? What was going on then?
Example. I think example. This man's father was also easy to work with. He had good relations with Congress, George Bush number one. But this guy thinks he should be President George rather than he should be King George, not President George. That's a problem he has. And I think that we need whoever the next president is, by example. That's how you get things done. Let's sit down and talk about it. Let's have people come down to the White House, not for one of the things I describe in my book where Pelosi and I are at a table. He goes around. He gives us a little travelogue on what he's done this week. And then he says, oh, you have a question? Okay. Takes the questions of us. We each get one question, a quick one, and then we go about, finish our scrambled eggs and leave. That's not the way you get things done. I can remember George Bush. I was a relatively new member of the Senate. And President Bush, number one, invited a number of people to the White House. I can remember Jack Kemp was one of the people invited. Jack Kemp was so excited. He said, I have never, ever been invited to the residence, second floor of the White House. Never. And George Bush, he says, don't tell Barbara. Let's go look at the bedroom. That's the kind of guy he was. And that's, people want, I have from George Bush, number one, some wonderful letters he wrote to me. I did some things that he liked, and he wrote me handwritten letters. I like those. We all do, because of that, you feel, oh, man, I want to try to work with this guy. That isn't what we've had now. This man came to town, as I said earlier, saying he wanted to be a uniter, not a divider. It's as if he was speaking with George Orwell's voice.
Hmm. Have you written handwritten letters to Republicans when you've liked their work?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have. There are times that you should express to, I mean, for example, I talk in my book. I say that Chuck Hagel is one of my all-time political heroes. This conservative Republican from Nebraska who was a war hero in Vietnam. He saved his brother's life in battle. He comes to Nebraska, is elected to the Senate. He started speaking out on the Sunday shows a little bit about the war, and then pretty soon he said, I can't take it anymore, and he joined with us. That's a political hero in my mind. And I don't know if I've ever written him a letter, but I don't need to because I've talked about him in my book.
One more question for the moment on the climate from the audience. A field poll shows that the president has, and I haven't seen the latest figures, but 38% approval rating, and we know it's very low. Congress's approval rating isn't much better. Why is that, and what can be done about that?
The President Bush has the lowest ratings a president's had since polling started in America.
Okay? How does Congress compare in that respect?
We're also low, but so is a county clerk someplace. Anytime you have a president that's so unpopular, it filters through. And remember, we have a situation now where, if you want my honest opinion, I think Congress should have a pretty low rating because we have not produced things. It's been difficult to do. Now, as I said earlier, if we are able to accomplish things, people don't care if it's a Democrat or Republican who gets it done. They just want something gotten done. Now, no wonder they're down in Congress. We're not getting anything done.
Now, you're majority leader. How much blame do you take for any of that?
I don't take much. because the Republicans broke a 2-year filibuster record in 10 months. They have basically they've not gotten over the snit that they lost, and we're in the majority. So as a result of that, we have been able to accomplish some things, but it has been difficult because of the procedure hurdles. They have in this Congress already, they're up to 77 filibusters. Every one of those, some of them they filibuster on things they agree on just to stall for time because every time you invoke cloture, there's 30 hours.
77 filibusters. Yeah. Do you recall a time when we've hit that number before?
No. They broke the 2-year record in 10 months. They're the Mark McGuire. They're on steroids, man.
We're going to turn.
I guess I shouldn't say Barry Bonds in San Francisco.
Probably not.
Okay.
We're going to turn to the campaign in a few minutes, but I want to stay on some of the other issues that you're addressing directly. How will the next Congress and the president address the looming problem of unfunded entitlement programs such as Social Security and Medicare? Will it be by raising taxes, lifting the earnings cap? What needs to be done? How big a crisis is this?
Let me first say this. One of the things that Republicans have done going back to the Reagan days is frighten people about Social Security. And it has been accentuated by this president. When George Bush ran for Congress and was beaten in the late 70s in Texas, he wanted to privatize Social Security way back then. He does not believe in government. He does not believe in government programs. He does not like Social Security. That's why he tried to privatize it when he became president. So everyone here understands Social Security is not about to go broke. If we do nothing with Social Security, zero, people will draw 100% of their benefits for the next 40 years. If we do nothing after that, they will still draw 80% of their benefits. Now, we should work to make sure that in the out years, the Social Security program is taken care of. Now, Medicare is a different issue. Bush has done everything he can to destroy Medicare, and he's doing quite well. We've been able to stop him of destroying Social Security. But Medicare, he's done a pretty good job of really damaging it. For example, he pushed through Congress, Republican-dominated Congress. He pushed through the fact that Medicare cannot negotiate for lower-priced drugs because he wants this all to be handled in the private sector. So right now, you can, if you have a big HMO, you can negotiate for lower-priced drugs. If you're an insurance company, you can, but not Medicare. Medicare is in trouble. Medicare is a program where it's going to take whoever the next president is some very hard work very quickly. It's part of the overall health care delivery problems we have in America today. But so Social Security is one issue. Medicare is another issue. So entitlement programs, there are other issues that we have to deal with. There's no question about it. But we shouldn't focus on Social Security because it's not the problem.
It's not the immediate crisis many may believe. What, in your judgment, other than the Iraq War, what, in your judgment, is the number one issue facing the United States of America that must be addressed?
Dan, there are two things. Not in order of importance, health care and global warming.
All right, let's talk about health care. Millions of Americans are uninsured, sadly. many others struggle with their insurance companies to stay covered, among many other issues. What needs to be done in this country vis-a-vis healthcare? And what realistically can
yes.
be done?
Healthcare is going to be helped, but it can't be done in the first year that we have a new president. It's going to take some time. This is a difficult issue. I think the one thing that we need to look at is take part of the old Clinton plan that failed because of the Harry and Louise ads. I think, for example, we should allow pooling. And what I mean by that is in the audience today, we may have an employer that has 50 people. We may have an employer that has 25 people and one that has 300 people. These people should be able to pool to get up to 7,000-8,000 people so that they can go get a decent insurance program. They can't do that now. What happens now if you're a small employer, you finally get an insurance policy, someone has an accident or has a dread disease, they cancel them or don't renew the insurance policy. So pooling is one place that the next president will go to help alleviate the problems with insurance. I think that we also have to understand that we have problems today that didn't exist 10 years ago. We have a situation dealing with Alzheimer's that is extremely expensive. We have no decent program for buying insurance for our golden years, health insurance. So these are a couple of issues that we need to deal with, but pooling would be the number one I think we should look to quickly.
It is a complex issue, obviously, but why, Senator, has it been so difficult to make any meaningful progress on something that does seem, I think, to the average yeah. small business, solvable?
Well, the Hillary Clinton health care plan, if we had that today, there would be very few complaints. It was a good program. And I was at an event similar to this in L.A. last night at UCLA, and a physician came up, and he said basically what I'm just saying now, that we should have taken the program when we had the chance. So it was stopped because of the insurance industry. When that program started, the Clinton health care plan, 80% of the American people thought it was a good idea. But after millions of dollars spent by the insurance industry frightening the American people with Harry and Louise ads, it reversed. Only 20% of the people after that thought it was a good idea. So that kind of put a damper on people trying to do anything. And then that during the Clinton years. And then comes the Republicans. And they simply were unwilling to do anything. They wanted these private health insurance programs, only helping people already have insurance. So that's why something hasn't been done. The last 7 years and 5 months, we've tried numerous times to get something done with the president, and he's been unwilling to allow us to do anything.
Do you think the next president really will be able to make any headway
oh, yes.
in this issue?
Yes, and as I said before, I don't think we should expect this problem to go away during the first year of the new president. But there are things that can be done that will alleviate the situation significantly. It used to be that health care was the number one financial problem that everyone had. Now it's gas prices.
Let's talk about gas prices, and I want to get back to global warming. It kind of ties in a little bit. Obviously, paying $4 a gallon for gasoline does not sit well with most Americans. It's a culture shock. But compared to what they spend in other parts of the world, it's not as exorbitant. What are we going to do? We're never going to go back to $2 a gas, it seems to me. Will we get back to $3 a gallon gas at least? Are we only going to continue to increase? What can be done about the price of gasoline?
In other countries, you understand that the taxes are significant.
That's true.
In Great Britain, for example, the comparable to a gallon of gas is about $4 in taxes. Ours is 18 cents.
Right. It's true.
So it's quite a difference. We are never going to be able to produce our way out of the problems we have. America, counting Anwar and offshore, we have 3% of the oil reserves of the world. So we can't produce our way out of the problems. Can we produce a little more and help? Yes. But today we are going to use 21 million barrels of oil in America. More than 65% of that is imported. Most of that importation comes from countries that are tyrannical governments, that are not our friends. So it seems to me that we have to figure a way to stop using so much foreign oil. And global warming is caused by fossil fuel, coal, and oil. So what are we going to do? Congress needs to And I don't think we can get it done the next 7 months. We're going to try real hard, but we can't get 67 votes to override a presidential veto. We've never gotten to 60 votes. We got 59 a few months ago, and we're going to try to pick up another one. But what we need to do is give our American entrepreneurs, most of whom are waiting here in California to invest the money. John Doerr, one of the great venture capitalists in America, has billions of dollars at his disposal to invest in alternative energy. But we need tax incentives to do this. And it's going to happen. It has to happen. We have the sun shines every day. It's wasted energy if we're not turning it into electricity. The same with wind. The same with geothermal. And that's where we need to go.
If you had your way, what would you do in terms of global warming, not only in the United States, but it's a world issue, obviously.
Yeah, first of all, what I would do in the United States is give an 8-year tax credit so that these venture capitalists will invest huge amounts of money in solar. It is amazing what can be done. The Nevada test site, where we set off over 1,000 nuclear devices, we could take a part of that test site, put solar panels on it, and supply enough electricity, not for Nevada, not for California, but the entire nation. Solar panels there. It would cover a lot of miles, but we have the miles, and we have the sun.
Is there any other country in the world that you have seen that has policies that you would think would work well here?
Australia.
What do they do?
Australia is, they're going to announce in Las Vegas within the next couple of weeks, there's a company, an Australian company that has some manufacturing facilities in Las Vegas. The company is called Asura. It's an Australian company. Excuse me, they have a lot of things going on here in California. They're going to announce next week that they're going to build in Australia, starting within the next year, a 10,000 megawatt solar plant. That is huge. And we can do the same here.
All right. Let's one more resource that I know you care about in Nevada a great deal, and that is water. There's been a lot of talk about desalination plants out west and other parts of the country. They do it, I know, in some places in the Middle East. Water is going to become a significant issue in the United States over the next few decades. Your concerns about that and what you think ought to be done to address it?
Well, I don't remember who it was. It could have been Mark Twain or one of those characters said that whiskey was for drinking, water is for fighting.
Yeah.
And I think that we're seeing that all over the world. The aquifer in the middle part of the United States, which has allowed this huge, one of the most fertile places, soil in the world, only place comparable is the Ukraine and the Pampas in Australia, is running out of water. Most of that land is irrigated, and the great, I can't pronounce the name, it's an Indian name, is this aquifer is depleted, and within the next 2 decades, they may not be able to pump water out of there anymore. But that's only one example. It's happening all over the world. Water is a problem. More than half the people in the world drink impure water, water that makes them sick. So you're absolutely right. There are some good things going on. The same man that invented the Segway, you know, that little scooter people mm-hmm. ride around on, he's also invented some wonderful things to produce water, pure water. His little machines, they're being used some places around the world today. He's just getting started, but they'll produce, I think, 35 or 40 gallons of water a day, and you can use anything to fuel his little machines. You can use manure, you can use wood, you can use anything. I mean, so there are some good things happening with water, but we have a shortage of it, and we're going to have to become more in tune with nature.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. We've talked about global warming. We've talked about the Iraq War. Let's talk for a moment, if we can, about the other crisis that people have been very concerned about. We talked about the energy policy and gasoline. Let's talk about the mortgage crisis in the country. Certainly your home state, Las Vegas, has been, in Nevada, in Las Vegas, has been devastated by the mortgage crisis, as a number of other places, Miami, Florida, Stockton, California, and other places. Whose fault was that, and should we have seen this coming realistically? What can we do to prevent this from happening again?
I would recommend, if you want to buy a home cheap and want to move to Vegas, we got some dandies there for you. Las Vegas has been on a 20-year boom. And one of my friends was telling me that he was in getting his hair cut. And a woman came up to him who was a manicurist. And she said to this, he's a boss on one of the strip hotels. And she said to him, I just bought my third condo. He said he knew right then we were in trouble. But in Las Vegas, for 20 years, you didn't have to be very smart to make money on real estate. So whose fault is it? There's probably a lot of blame to go around, but I place most of the blame on Alan Greenspan. I think that he, this know-it-all, I call him the J. Edgar Hoover of the financial world. He did anything he could to get in good with the next president. He spent more time going on the social circuit than focusing on what was going on with all these subprime loans. They were fraudulent, they were unfair, and
did he know that, or should he have known that?
He should have known. If he didn't know, as we say in the law, if he didn't know, he should have known it. So if you have to pick one person at fault, I pick him. But of course, there are others that we need to look at. I think that we've had a number of Secretary of Treasuries that should have been able to flag this better than they should have, and that goes back even to the Clinton years. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of blame to go around. All these new things that people are generating to make money. We have hedge funds, we have derivatives, and all this kind of stuff. And I think that we have been in an era of non-regulation, whether it's airline industries, whether it's transportation generally, and banking. We've just backed off, and there's too little regulation. And even a lot of the people who you would never think on Wall Street are saying there should be more regulation.
Do you think turning those mortgages into commodities, basically, which is what happened, was a big part of the problem?
Of course it was, yeah. We have found that and all this is that we still not – all the dirty linen hasn't been washed yet. But we're going to find that there are some very bad things went on. We've now discovered that some of these chains in it was a chain operation – that along the step, people, if they saw a bad loan, they were paid on how much money they got in. And boxing these loans together, they wouldn't. No one wanted them to say there were bad loans because they made money on how many they put together. So it's not all over with yet, but it's a tremendous crisis. It's not going to go away tomorrow.
Here's a question from the audience, Senator. Is Congress performing its oversight function sufficiently? And you could talk a little bit about perhaps the mortgage crisis to some degree, but just in general. If not, why is this the case, and how is this problem rectified?
The answer to the person in the audience is no, Congress has not been doing their job. During the 6 years of the first 6 years of the Bush administration, there were no hearings held on anything, no oversight hearings at all, not only on the war, not on the housing industry, not on anything. Now we have, during the last
steroids year, in baseball.
Well, that's quite important, isn't it? They would have been better off looking at the steroids and filibustering than steroids. But I think that we have done a decent job during the short time that we have been in charge of the country legislatively. We've had 75 hearings on one way or the other on the war in Iraq. Now these are not witch hunts. These are just trying to find out what's going on. Congressional oversight is one of our constitutional responsibilities. And whenever there's a lack of oversight, it's a lack of good government, in my opinion.
And I said that just to be amusing, but there is a point to be made there. The stories that grab the headlines, the easily digestible issues, the easy-to-tackle issues, steroids in baseball versus health care versus the mortgage industry versus the war. Why does Congress spend so much time sometimes on some of these issues?
You know, there's a book, Peter Principle. This used to be a big book.
Yeah.
And one of the little chapters in that book talks about the British Parliament. The British Parliament is debating the budget for the next year. And they're walking through all this defense stuff. It's done. Transportation, it's all done. They come to the annual Christmas party. And they spend some time on that baby because everyone understands that. This right. other stuff is hard to understand. I mean, to do a congressional hearing on financial derivatives, oh, that's kind of boring.
Yeah.
Important as it might be, it's still kind of boring. Or you get into some of the intricacies of the banking world. That's difficult. So that's why I think that even though we can't conduct everything with steroids on in baseball or whatever it is, I think it's done that way just because of the Christmas party.
Theory,
yeah. Okay.
Let's turn for a few moments that we have to the campaign. And let me, John McCain calls himself the straight-talking express. Let me ask you a straight-talk answer. Who is going to be the next president of the United States?
We will know this 1 week from today. It'll be whoever gets the Democratic nomination. Everyone knows at this stage that unless something goes unusual, it appears it'll be Obama. But right now, that has not been determined. But by next week at this time, it'll all be over with on the Democratic side.
Obviously, well before the convention, the Democratic Party wants this thing settled.
Today's Thursday. It may be Friday, but it's. And I've talked to Pelosi today. I talked to Dean last night, and we're in agreement that this thing's going to end real quick.
Okay. And Pelosi said that actually yesterday on our newscast, was commenting that it'll be over by next week. In terms of the superdelegates, how do you believe they should vote?
Well, first of all, the superdelegate thing has kind of been blown out of proportion. I have a different view than a lot of people. I've been in all my political jobs until 1982 were part-time jobs. But my whole adult life has been spent doing something in government. And it's no secret that the political parties are usually run by the Democrats, the far left, the Republicans by the far right. And so there were conventions that I simply didn't go to because I didn't want to have to make love to these left-wing characters that ran the party in Nevada, okay? So I just wouldn't go. So the DNC thought that was inappropriate, that people who held high public office couldn't go to the national convention. So that's why superdelegates were created, in my mind. So you just didn't have to deal with these characters that run these state parties. And we've never had a situation where it's mattered what we do, but now it does. And so rather than the reason I've given you, now we have another reason. That is to try to determine who's going to be president.
And to that end, do you think the superdelegates should vote just the way they're – do you think they should go against their
– No, I think superdelegates should vote for the person they think is going to be the best. If a candidate X took California and you have a superdelegate that disagrees, I think that person should have the right to vote whichever he or she wants to go.
From the audience, Senator, would you characterize Barack Obama as a moderate Democrat or to the left of moderate?
I think that Barack Obama's gotten a real bad rap. They say the most liberal member of the Senate. Hey, I'm in the Senate. I know who's the most liberal members of the Senate, and he's not one of them. He just hasn't voted very much. You know, he's been out on the campaign trail, so they picked just a few things. Let me talk about Barack Obama and then briefly about Hillary Clinton. And if I could just diverge just a little bit.
Sure.
I think this primary has been wonderful for our country. We have had a situation where, take Nevada as an example. For the first time in a generation, we have tens of thousands of more Democrats registered than Republicans. Pennsylvania, we have more than 4 million Democrats registered there for the first time in the history of our country. Arkansas, during the last year and a half, they've had a pickup in Democratic participation by 18%. In Kansas, and there's been a change in party affiliation and representation and activity by 2,500%.
Really?
2,500%. 11 Republicans switched parties in Kansas, became Democrats. This has been a great process. We have more than 3 million people who weren't in the process before that are now in the process. It's wonderful. And talk about campaign financing. We didn't pass a fancy law in Washington to change campaign way campaigns are financed. The people did it on the internet. Barack Obama's raised $160 million. Average contribution less than $90. That speaks well for our country. So I don't lament this campaign taking as long as it has, but it's time it ended. And I think I lost your question.
I may have as well. Going forward, let me focus on assuming it ends next week. We were talking about whether Obama is moderate or left of moderate.
And I wanted to just talk about those two people just a little bit because I know them very well.
You wanted to comment on Obama and then on Hillary Clinton.
Yes. Barack is an interesting man. He is such a, how would I say it, just a mellow guy. Never gets upset. Perfect example is after he lost Ohio and Texas, they have a big meeting, all the campaign people. And that's the time you fire people, okay? It's time. You lost these two big states. They have the meeting. He walks in and he says, I haven't done my job. You haven't done very good either. Let's go out and win this election. Hmm. I mean, that's the kind of guy he is. He and Hillary Clinton are absolutely brilliant. You know, they both have educations to prove it. Hillary Clinton is a person, she's very intense, very smart, and I think a wonderful legislator. So that's what I think about the two. I've already commented on McCain. I don't need to harp on that again.
Are you, as we reach the last few minutes of our conversation, from Searchlight to Washington, the subtitle of your book, are you still, despite your concerns about the Iraq War, your concerns about where we are with health care, the divisiveness in Washington, D.C., are you truly optimistic that things can improve? And I know the easy answer is yes, of course they will. This is America. But is there really any turning back the level of acrimony and divisiveness in Washington? Are we going to move forward from here? Is there so much scarring
done? Dan, I believe the American people want this turned back. I believe that I know Democrats do, and I am hopeful and confident Republicans will see the writing on the wall and stop this filibustering, everything comes around. You know, we're going to pick up a seat in Mississippi. We're going to win in North Carolina. I mean, we really are. So I just think that the time has come when we have all these problems that we've outlined, global warming, the war in Iraq, healthcare, education system that's not doing very well. We're leaving a lot of children behind in our education system. There are so many things that we need to do. We need to get our financial ship back on the right track. I just have a really good feeling that this is going to happen.
All right. How has Washington we talked about how your hometown of Searchlight, Nevada has shaped you. How has Washington shaped and changed you?
Well, there isn't a day that goes by that I come to work and I think, gee whiz, I can't imagine I'm going to come into this Capitol and spend the day here. And I have an office that is the nicest office in all, nicest office in all Washington that goes with my job. I just have great confidence that everything Washington stands for is good for our country and good for the world. And I don't want to harp on this, but it's in my book. I mean, where else could you, whatever country you go to where some kid learned to swim in a whorehouse swimming pool and now be the majority leader of the Senate, huh?
I can't imagine any other place.
Sometimes I have trouble imagining.
There's a couple last questions from the audience that people may not know. Here's a question. Did your boxing career almost take you to the 1960 Olympics?
Not even close.
But people may not realize that about you. And one last question here from the audience, which I can't resist, and I saved it from the very beginning. If I were to buy one political memoir this year, should it be yours or Scott McClellan's?
Well, let me say this. I'm donating all the proceeds of my book to charity, okay? So I'm going to make that decision by the first year what charities to go to. So Scott probably needs the money more than I do. So.
And you've heard his book will be out officially in a few days. What does that say about the Bush administration that Scott McClellan has written this scathing attack?
Well, I think it's kind of the something that we've always felt. I mean, to sit and talk to Valerie Plame, okay? This very attractive woman. Nicole Kidman's going to play her part in the movie.
Right.
And that they both look alike. That's a good casting. This woman was a spy for us. She was an undercover agent for us. And they revealed her personality, ruined her career. That's what he's talking about in his book. And it only confirms that worst presidency in the history of our country. That's, I say in my book, that he'll go down as the worst president we ever had. And, you know, I know a little bit about other presidents.
All right. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of our program today. And our thanks to Senator Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader and author of The Good Fight, Hard Lessons from Searchlight to Washington. And that is quite a story you tell, from a small town in Nevada to the seat of power in Washington, D.C. Please give a big warm round of applause and thanks to Senator Harry Reid. Heartfelt gratitude for a heartfelt discussion, Senator. Thank you very much. And thank you to all of you here in the room with us at the Commonwealth Club and those of you listening on the radio. I want to remind everyone here to please stay seated until Senator Reid has left the room. Thank you. I'm Dan Ashley, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.